Roy Milner, Reel 6.
You said one or two fellows married Anglo-Indians. Mm. Was that frowned upon?
Not that I was aware. The people that I know who did, I couldn't say that they were actually buddies of mine, although I knew them quite well. I remember in particular one sergeant who married an Anglo-Indian girl out there. And when we left India, he stayed there. I think this was one of the things that could happen. You were in the Dorset Regiment. The Dorset Regiment are moving home as a regiment. You've married an Anglo-Indian. You merely transfer to another regiment that's staying out there for some time. Or you transfer to something like the Indian Police, Bengal Police or something like that. So that you have a footing in India. We never heard of him again, that particular individual. That's one that I do remember who got married out there. And there were a couple of others who had Anglo-Indian brides, and I don't know whatever happened to them. Thinking of them now, they may well have stayed there too. They may well have transferred, because I can't recall any of them being in Malta with the Anglo-Indian brides. But we do know, it was one of those things, it was tended to be a step up the social scale to marry a white soldier.
Though then presumably it would be a step down for them, for the soldier.
Well, I suppose it depends upon your point of view. You know, everybody's crazy when they're in love. They don't think of anything like that. And they may, in retrospect, have said, good God, I married beneath me, or something like this. But at the time, I suppose, if you've had a Dear John letter, you know, you've left a girl behind in England, she said, Dear John, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but, you know, I've gone and married another bloke. Then you sort of kick over the traces, I suppose, and go and marry the first bird that says yes, or something like this. I don't know. Because everybody's a different individual. Everybody's an individual, I believe, and everybody reacts differently to the same sort of tale. I mean, I had a Dear John letter, but it didn't turn me over to that extent. I just accepted it, and I thought, well, I'm enjoying myself out here. What the hell, anyway? There's nothing I can do about it, and away I went. The letter wasn't unexpected, because when I first went to India, I still had friends in England in the regiment. And by the time we'd exchanged a couple of letters, I knew that my bird was hawking around with somebody else in the regiment. And I thought, in my wakeful moments, oh, I'm good now, I can... well, if she can do that, I don't want to know. Really? Do I want to know? Oh, I can't make up my mind. I couldn't care less. Then I wrote and said, I'm putting in for a blighty leave. And then I thought, I've put in for a blighty leave. Do I want to go and see her? No, she's been kicking off with old so-and-so. He's out here now. So I wonder who it is now. And I knew she was a good-looking bird and so forth, and well-built, and had that bit of oomph, I suppose, that we used to look for when we were 20. And I thought, no, I don't really care. But I haven't got to fold it up completely, because she's got a suitcase of mine full of my plain clothes and this and that and that, and I want to collect it. So I let it go on, and I said I was coming home on leave, and I went to my sister's in Hertfordshire, and then I drew a month's pay, it was about £8, month's pay and ration money, and I went down to Dover, and I collected my suit. I saw her, and I collected my suitcase, and said, cheers. And we exchanged rings, because we were engaged, we exchanged rings. And that sort of thing. Did we exchange rings? It came up. I forget whether we actually did. I think I flogged mine in the end. Forget. But well, I didn't bother. It didn't really upset me. Now, I stayed in this country on about 3 or 4 months on leave, and I didn't really bother about getting another permanent female attachment. It was here today and gone tomorrow, sort of thing, and I moved around. And I then heard that she'd got married. And when I came home after the war, I went on a weekend to, I don't know, one of those places down the south coast where people go on weekends. And I took a day off and went to Dover. Saw her mum and dad, and then went to see her. And I came away and I thought, one of those things, isn't it? Could have been me.
And there were some English women in India who weren't married, the daughters of men, civilians officers. Perhaps, and of officers.
Mm.
Did you ever have any way of seeing them socially?
I only saw them through, the dance band, because we used to play at the officers' dances and we saw the officers' wives, and some we used to chat to, because some at that time were not married, some were just courting. There were also married pads, what an awful name, some married sergeants and that sort of thing, and one or two others who were married. And I wouldn't say we mixed socially, we casually met socially and it was forgotten. I don't think the majority of us really wanted to meet them. They were spoken for, let's not bother. It's too much trouble, you know what I mean? They had their way of life. Don't forget, you couldn't get anything clandestine going anyway, because when you were off duty, so was our old man. So what? Even if you were bigger than him, it didn't make sense to get embroiled. And there's only one man that I know who used to get embroiled. He's on that picture of the crazy crowd dance band, and that was the drum major. And he was a hell of a guy. A real womanizer. And when I was in hospital with my pleurisy, I found out he was in the next ward. I was in the medical ward, he was in the surgical ward. And I said, what happened to him? And they said, somebody caught him with his missus and flattened him. And his scalp wound and everything, you know. And when we left India, I think he stayed out there. Or he went back there, that might have been the thing, he went back there. And anybody who talks about him now, Drummy Stark, womanizer all the way. But he was about the only one. I don't think anybody else got mixed up.
Anyone in hospital with VD?
Very few, because it cost an awful lot of money. You see, if you get onto that particular subject, there's no reason why you shouldn't. You used to get a lecture about the dangers of VD, and you used to be told at that time the ways to avoid it. The greatest way to avoid it is not to indulge, which none of us believed anyway. One of the diseases I was scared stiff of. So they took precautions beforehand, and they took precautions afterwards. And I'm not going to have this recorded. If one had VD, you see, you can't hide it, because there weren't the sulfonamide drugs in those days. You would have to report sick to get it cleared up, and you would lose, it would be up to ninepence a day. You would lose your threepence proficiency and your sixpence for having both your shot and your proficiency pay. If you got the two, you'd get an extra tanner. That was the sort of thing. This made you pay from 2 bob a day to 3 bob a day. So you would lose ninepence, and that was a lot of money in those days to lose per day until you were cured. And it might take weeks and weeks. I don't know. I never had it. It was one of the things I was frightened of.
At Ranikhet, for example, they had an official brothel where the girls were checked out by medical officers.
Yes. where when you went in, you put a little thing in the letterbox to say what number girl you had, and at what time and at what date. And they were all cleared from the little post boxes, and if you reported sick and said, yes, I have a dose, which is the common term, I have a dose, and the bloke would say, where did you get it? And you said, up the regimental brothel. When? And they'd bring all the tickets out, and they'd say, number two. So a medical report, never, never, you didn't get it there. And then it's found, you see, that he didn't. He probably went down the bazaar and paid a rupee or something like this and had some old bag from the bazaar. But he would say regimental brothel so that he wouldn't tend to lose his proficiency pay, because if you have a regimental brothel, then you're entitled to use it. So, yes, we know about those things, but they were washed out. They were washed out, I think, about the time I got to India. My regiment never had a regimental brothel while I was there. That's for sure. But I do know they still existed, because from time to time, particularly on troop ships, when I was coming home on leave, I met people who said, yes, they had a regimental brothel. And I said, oh, we don't have one. Oh, we do. I think it depends where you were stationed. If you were stationed in a place like Lucknow, which is probably one of the hottest places in India, there's no reason why your blood shouldn't get hot either. I mean, it's a natural function, so, I mean, why be shy and reticent about it? We know it went on. One of the other things that I do know is that I believe it was Kitchener, maybe not Kitchener, Roberts, who said that there would be a lack of female company in India. You can always sleep with your buddy. What did he call him? Your mate or something. And one knows, this is homosexuality, that there is homosexuality in the army. But it tends to be on a very small scale, considering the number of men thrown together and the amount of the lack of female company. But what I found was that lots of people didn't bother. They said, ah, well, you could always go on leave, you see, and you could find it on leave. In fact, it would be nothing to go on leave and take your dairy bundle into your room and throw it on the charpoy. And when you come back at night, it's already made down. There's somebody sitting on the end of the bed waiting for you. And you either said, go away, naughty girl, or you said, well, get undressed and get into bed. So, you know, it's so easy. And you paid the bloke for bringing her in. Or you might go and say, don't forget, I want a teak eye bibby tonight when I come in. I should be half canned, but I want a teak eye bibby on my bed when I come in. And there'd be one there. It was as simple as that. I didn't indulge. I don't say that to whitewash myself, but I say it because I'm scared of it.
Were they always Indian women?
Everyone that I came across who indulged to that extent was always Indians, half-castes or Indians. I think here again it depended where you were stationed, because if you got down to places like Bombay, Calcutta, you could meet up with Japanese, even Chinese, Malays and these sort of people. But it's a worldwide profession, and I suppose one might say beggars can't be choosers. I mean, if there's only Indians available, then it Indians it is.
Why do you think the incidence of homosexuality would be so low?
I think there's a big percentage of people who don't just frown on it, but just completely abhor it. You know, they would call it a stinking great and all sorts of rude words. And I think he would feel about it. What I found happened in my regiment was that there would be perhaps three or four known puffs, is the term. Their trade might be brisk, but it wouldn't go on to any greater extent, that's the thing. And you can even be approached. I mean, we have a a rather good system out there. You don't borrow money off... You can borrow off each other, but... a sure way to get it is to go to the quarter bloke and get blue lights. These are little squares of linen stamped with a price. And they're blue. This is why they're called blue lights. And you go up and you say, can I have 2 rupees worth of blue lights colour? Now, they won't give these to the young soldiers. But the young soldiers would approach you while you're queuing up to get them. I'll do you a favour. Get some blue lights. This sort of thing. I've been approached like that. That's how I know. I'm speaking factual. And I said, go away. Words to that effect. And I just got my blue lights because I didn't have time. I didn't think it was the right thing. And the chaps I moved around with didn't think it was the thing. I don't... There was one in the drums. Oh, yes, there was one in the... There was two in the drums, actually. And one was an old soldier. Old Tom Cooper. Oh, I have to think. But why it was so... thinly spread elsewhere. I don't really know. I think the people probably thought, no, it's not worth the risk. Because if you got caught, I think you'd be clobbered good and proper. Now, I do know of one who had VD. A young soldier. And when I came back from my leave in 1938, he was one of the people who was in barracks when I arrived back. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm on my way home. And he hadn't been in India 5 minutes. And I didn't get it from him, but I got it from his sort of colleagues. I said, well, what has he got over? I said, you know. He's been handing it out, boy. I said, really? Yeah. He's dosed up. He's been sent back to Blighty. Never seen nor heard of the man from that day. The boy, he was a young lad, about 18. Never seen or heard of him from that day to this. Never know what happened to him. But you see, they'd get rid of you that way.
Was part of the emphasis on sports and handicrafts and busy things because the army may have feared that there'd be a problem with homosexuality?
Never having moved in the top echelons, I wouldn't know, but I would have thought that was a very good guess. You know, that's a very good point. I would have said, yes, perhaps so. Don't forget, all these officers also were interested in sport. There was polo and there was horse riding, this sort of thing. And I would think that the chap who was a homosexual would be frowned on to such an extent that... he would tend to hide his head under his arm, sort of thing. He wouldn't be popular at all. Except with that, there is a breed of person, and there's quite a number of pop stars today who boast about it, I think. There is a breed of person who would go for that type of, what would you call it, entertainment, enjoyment, or satisfaction, what have you. But the others, I think, were much too busy enjoying life to bother with it. I'm grown up now, and I can look back over my life and can put my feelings about sex into, you know, sort of brackets and say, well, I was very active, very inquisitive, very randy, if that's the right word, between the ages of about 16 and 20. Till I went abroad. When I went abroad, I'd had so many gory stories about VD that I tended to withdraw from it. And I think I expended my energy in sports and pastimes and this sort of thing. Nothing was ever too much trouble. I used to drink a lot of beer and do a lot of running and sweat it all out and loll around in showers and things like this. But that period in my life... sex didn't bother me very much, at all. Even when I came home on leave. I don't know why. But I wasn't particularly bothered about it. Of course I had girlfriends over here. but I didn't sort of whine and say I'm being upset if they said, no, I'm not meeting you tomorrow, it's all right, it's somebody else, you know. I don't know whether I didn't have time for them or couldn't be bothered or what, but I just didn't somehow. Then I went back to India, and soon after that, of course, we moved on to Malta. Now, Malta was a different thing altogether. I mean, Malta was the permissive society after India. Talk about having it thrown at you. Almost literally, I might say. So that's...
Still in India. What was the calibre of the officers that you got? Did they send out the ones they wanted to get rid of and didn't want in England? Or did they send out good ones to handle difficult situations?
I know what you've been listening to. You've been listening to somebody say about a son that never could make it. Oh, never mind, we'll buy him a commission to send him off to India. I think that's it's a bit far-fetched. I said earlier that I thought boys, young men, grew up very quickly in India, and I think the calibre of officers that I came across in my regiment were top. I can't think of any officer in the regiment, even Indian officers, and we had an Indian company, that weren't first class. I think all the officers were first class. I still see some of them today and chat them up. Matter of fact, I was talking about people who weren't married, were courting their wives at the time. Our president today is one of them, and he was a one pipper, and I didn't have one stripe on my arm in those days, and he was courting this bird, and he's now married, of course, and he's our president. He lives down Dorset, and we meet occasionally. I meet his wife, and I say, good heavens, we haven't met since, and she say, do you remember my favourite song? And I said, yeah. She says, go on and sing it. So I sing it to her. And she said, yeah, that's right. Fancy you remembering after all those years. I said, it isn't that you know, I remember the song that way. I remember the dance band days and the things we did. And Desmond, her husband, we call each other Desmond and Roy now. But in those days it was, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. And Milner, come here. You know, that sort of thing. Oh, I think they were good officers. And we used to have people like Australian officers attached, Canadian officers attached. All great guys. Oh, and they'd play football, they'd box. One of them today is the governor of Dartmoor Prison. And I remember announcing him in a boxing ring. Now, look, listen to this. We used to have official boxing matches, and we used to raise one up for a Sunday. After church, that's a boxing match. And I'd be the ringmaster and say, on my left at 110 pounds, Digger Golding. Captain. Digger? Digger Golding at 182 pounds, and on my left, Shirley Cheesecake. At, you know. How many of you, Mr. Timekeeper? But all COD stuff, you see, but the officers all turned in. And I'd have three or four officers on the programme, all up in the boxing. You know. But it was all encouraged, and they were good. They were good. None of the officers I came in contact with were second rate. Not in my opinion. Anyway.
Did you ever have any contact with the Indian Army, training with them or maneuvering?
Well, we did. This is where that funeral thing came. Our brigade, which is one English regiment, three native, that's a brigade, they trained together. And I just happened to be one of those that was left back in camp on this occasion when the Indian regiment next to us, and I would think they were the one regiment left for the whole camp as a sort of guard, when they mutinied. There was really a dozen of us left in this camp. We had to go over there and stand guard. I mean, they could have slaughtered us as well, but we had contact to that extent, and we had contact to the extent that we had a native company who looked after the mules. It was a mule. That was our transport. Oh, very up to date. That was our transport company But it was all native. And yes, how much contact? You and I together, let's go down and learn the language. He's learning English, and I'm learning Urdu. And he's in the next classroom to me. And when the school is over at night, probably 7 o'clock, we met outside. And he would have the flash up which said he's Dorset, you see. And he would know I was Dorset because I'd have the flash in my puggery. And we'd meet and say hello. And we'd walk along. And he would show me his book where it said, I have lost my hat, in English. And I'd show him mine, which said, Lila Hobo Pie, please keep off the track, or something like that. So we mixed to that extent, you see. And the officers of those native platoons were great, oh yes. One of ours was in the paper recently. It's drawn to our attention by our officers and said, does anybody remember this chap? He used to be our platoon commander at Selcott in 1936. And here he is now, he's a big noise in the Indian Army or something there. So yes, even the native officers I found were first class in the regiment. Those six officers that were shot, they must have been first class. One of the highlights of an officer's career is to be selected to go to the Gurkha regiments. A chap who was a one pipper when I was a young soldier rose to be a colonel of one of the Gurkha battalions. That's a great thing. So that's the caliber of them. And you can't say better than that. I still see him today. And he remembers me. He said, ah, old intelligence section, eh? Because we used to do intelligence, if you're in the drums. And I said, yes. And we always remember one incident. Doing training for intelligence work. At Dover it was. And he had a little, it must have been one of the old Austin 7s, and it was blue. And on this particular occasion, it represented an armoured car. And we would be sitting up, making notes of what we could see going on, you know. And we all turned in this thing. We all noted this armoured car proceeding in a westward direction. And he always remembers that. So do I, actually. But that's part of fun and games of life, of remembering. And it's the same with everybody you meet. India comes up, Malta comes up, all the places we've been abroad comes up, sooner or later. And it's a great life. I don't know why I've got them on. They're my reading glasses.
You told me how some of the men treated some of the Indian civilians. Did that also happen with Englishmen treating Indian soldiers badly?
No. No. Never. Let's take them separately. First of all, the soldiers. Your own platoon in your own regiment, never. They were always treated well. Although they tended to keep to themselves. We'd meet with the officers and that, but they tended to keep themselves, except on occasions like I've just explained, if you met going to the Munshi to learn a language. With regard to other troops outside your regiment, the contact was minor. I mean, that was that regiment. All right, you might play them at football if they played football. There's nothing. Now, with the Johnny Gurkha, different kettle of fish altogether. The more we could mix together, the better we liked it. The Johnny Gurkha was the only ones allowed in our canteen, and we were allowed in theirs. But you couldn't go into another Indian canteen.
Why was that? What's the difference?
One doesn't know. The Johnny Gurkha, you see, had a contract with the British government to go everywhere where there was fighting. And the Johnny Gurkha thought, and he probably still thinks, that there's nobody like the British. And anything British, they love. You can play them a game of football. They play football because it's British. You can beat them 10-0. They couldn't give a tinker's cuss. They played football because it's British. That's how they were. We've done on bugling sessions with the Johnny Gurkhas and that sort of thing. Very smart little men and everything. Oh, great soldiers. No, I